All right. I just had to throw that in there. I've been feeling like this 70s vibe this entire week. Well, depends on when you're watching or listening to this. It's all the time. I've got that 70s type of vibe. I've been seeing it on social media and stuff. You know, I don't know if you're old enough, but if you are, you know exactly what I mean about the music, about the times. It was such a great time. A close second is going to be the 80s. Yep, hair metal, all that kind of stuff. Anyhow, I got something else to bring up with all of you out there that's listening right now. So if you're a pet owner, please remember to have your pets spayed or neutered. It is very, very important to do that. All right, so let's get right into it. My guest today is Dana Killian. She is a brand new author of a memoir. Her memoir is very appropriately titled, Where the Shadows Dance. But before we get into that, she is also a fiction writer, so you may have heard her name before. So she has several fiction books out there. So look up Dana Killian. But her memoir is about, I'm going to say, her struggles going through helping somebody who was an addict. And this person she loved very much, her husband. Now, some of you out there may have gone through this similar situation where you're helping an addict, whether it be a loved one or friend, but I'm going to come right out and say it. A lot of times, we become victims, and also, a lot of times, we don't help when we think we're helping that addict. We become enablers. We become a person that, well, simply put, we enable them to do what they are doing because we are trying to help. Sometimes we also end up blaming ourselves by asking, what have I done wrong? Or why isn't it working? So many different things. So that's why I say a lot of times we end up becoming victims. You're going to hear some terminologies that's going to be used or thrown around in this podcast, but these are probably words and terminologies that you've heard many times before if you are familiar with addicts and addiction. So please sit back, listen to the podcast, or if you're watching the podcast, please watch and listen. The other thing too is please remember to share this and all podcasts that are on Amazing People, Amazing Things. It really does help with the algorithm. So like, share, and comment. So if you're ready, let's go ahead and get right into it. Dana, today we're going to talk about, you know, all these topics that we come across are very, very important. But when it comes to addiction, trauma, alcoholism, whatever the addiction is very important. I know that September is the Addiction Awareness Month, but we should be aware of all this trauma and addiction every day, every week, every month. Because I don't think that there is one person out there who has not been affected or who at least does not know someone who has had trauma or addiction. With that being said, can you kind of give us a rundown of how you got, is hooked the wrong word, but you know, what happened, how this came about, and then, you know, you are a mystery writer. You have 5 books out. Then you have your own memoir coming out here called Where the Shadows Dance. So can you kind of give us this background?
Sure. As you mentioned, I'm typically a fiction writer. I write a mystery series. So jumping into memoir was a new thing for me. And it came out of my experience of being in a long-term marriage to an alcoholic, a very high-functioning alcoholic. So it was difficult to understand what was happening for a really long time. You know, what is the difference between drinking that is heavier than mine versus problem drinking? And it took quite a bit of effort to figure out what was going on. And it also took quite a bit of effort, once we figured out what was going on, for my former husband to understand this was not something he could control. High-functioning addicts get around life quite well. The world doesn't see them in the conventional sense. We all have images of addicts, or alcoholics anyway, as people that are slurring and stumbling and being obnoxious and losing their jobs and car accidents, all of those things. And those were not behaviors that my former husband exhibited during our marriage. He would drink, certainly, but he would pass out. He would, you know, occasionally not remember what was going on, but it was none of the extreme behaviors. And that in itself has all kinds of challenges, and we can get into that if you'd like. But I found eventually part of my path to healing was actually talking about it, which is where this book comes in. My experience of being the loved one, the person on the sideline of addiction, was an experience that I hadn't been around. I hadn't been around addiction. And as I found, as time went on, as things got deeper, as things got more complicated, I found that the resources available to me were really slim. The entire addictive journey is really focused on the addict, as it should be. But unfortunately, in that process, we are minimizing the trauma that occurs to everyone on the sidelines. So I'll give you the why of the book, and then we can kind of get into details. So the why of the book basically became, eventually, my belief that if I could find my voice about something that I hadn't been talking about, not only would I be helping myself, but I would be helping anybody else who has been on the sidelines. I could give voice to the experience, to the pain, to let people know that they are not alone, and to let people know that they don't have to stay broken, that there is healing that can occur. We just have to recognize that we have a right to heal, that we have a responsibility to ourselves to heal.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the thing is, with alcoholism or any type of addiction, that addict is that one person. Mm-hmm. But that addict affects many. Mm-hmm. So it becomes this large group that's affected by one person. And I think oftentimes the addict may not realize that. They may realize and understand, well, this is my problem, but they don't understand, no, this is everyone's problem that you are around. It affects all of us. That's at least my perception.
Oh, you're absolutely right with that. Addiction, regardless of whatever that substance is, it is a highly self-centered experience. Mm-hmm. Because the addict is needing the substance, trying to hide the substance, trying to pretend that they don't have a problem, waiting, you know, the lying about, have I been drinking? Haven't I been drinking? How do I get to my next drink? There is so much lying involved that the addict is so focused on themselves, they just don't have the capacity to really understand what's happening to those around them. Yeah. And that's often where you hear about these intervention moments where family members and concerned loved ones bring the addict into a room and say, look, honey, you got to do something. Not always effective, but it is that mirror moment that the addict sometimes needs at least that nudge in that direction to say, wait a minute, you're all worried about me. I am somehow hurting others. Necessary part of the process, but you're absolutely right. The self-centeredness is just, it's not intentional. It is simply part of the disease.
Yeah. And like you're saying too, there's, we hear of and we know a lot of resources for the addict themselves, but not as many or not as well known help for the person that is affected by the addict. So I have not read your book, your memoir, but my assumption from our short conversation so far is this is where you're leaning towards, is helping those who have been affected by, whether it's your spouse, you know, close loved one, or somebody that's immediate around that addict. Because I believe we get caught up, we meaning the loved one of the addict, and we do not realize when we become codependent. You know, so I'd like to maybe touch on, what is codependency? What is that? How do we know that we've gotten to the point of being codependent? Because I think a lot of people, when you say, oh, you're codependent, they say, oh, no, I'm not. But now we're defending ourselves when we have become addicted to being a codependent. So what is codependency? What is being codependent?
It's actually not a phrase I'm a fan of, because it seems to minimize the complexity of the situation. In most committed relationships, in most loving relationships, we aren't intentionally trying to do anything. Codependent almost suggests that I need this person to stay addicted. That was my initial reaction. But it doesn't really work that way, because it's, from my perspective, this is something that evolves over time. One, when we are in a loving relationship, we want this person that we love to be healthy and safe. And that's what our initial foray into please get help is all about. And the love is behind all of it. We are loving them enough to want them to get sober, and loving them enough that we live in this place of fear. Fear for their life, fear for what the potential consequences are, car accidents, financial ruin. We live in that place, and I don't think of most of us as needing the addict to stay sick, but more of a place perhaps where we don't know what the line is between loving them and loving ourselves. And it's a really, really hard place to be when you love someone and you're watching them die in front of your eyes, or knowing that eventually they're going to. This can be a spouse, this can be a child, this can be anybody that you have deep feelings for, and you're watching them slowly destroy themselves. Yeah. And most of us, with people we love, we're going to go to pretty extreme lengths to try to help that individual get to a place of sobriety and healing. And if, you know, if we think about it from the standpoint of how far would you go for someone you love? That's a different way to look at this idea of codependency. I never felt I needed him to be sick, but damn, it was hard to walk away. Because I couldn't see the line. And we are in that place of, okay, I know this is destroying me, but I also love this man. And if I leave him because I'm dying, what happens to him? I mean, think about that with someone you love, or your child, because that is the ultimate fear. When we say no more, we are the last thread holding this person to any kind of reasonable life. Yeah. So the labels around codependency and enabling, I think they just become a little bit catchphrases from the world of, you know, pop psychology. Not that they aren't real things, but they get used in ways and they get thrown out as very simple concepts. Now, for me, enabling would be buying him booze because I want him to drink at home. I didn't do that. You know, that would be an example of enabling behavior. Calling into work for him. You know, things that would put me in between him and the consequence. Mm-hmm. That's kind of how I have come to view enabling as a term, or codependence. I guess I struggle with that a little bit more, because I don't really think most of us want the person to, we don't need this person to stay sick. Right. It is not our, we have caregiver in us, but it is not our desire to keep them sick so we can be the savior and the caregiver. We want them sober. We want our good life back. So, you know, it's not that it's a concept I dismiss. I just like to talk about it in ways that are a little more broad so that we aren't just throwing out sound bites about, oh, you're enabling. And that's the kind of stuff that comes up a lot when you go into group meeting sessions. How are you enabling him? How are you codependent?
Right. And I think that's because it is in the book and that's the way it's been written. And that's what we follow, that guide, where I am in agreement with what you're saying. I can see where being an enabler is easier to justify is the wrong word, but to say, well, enabling, because you're that go-between of whatever, and it's a physical type of thing. It's there. Mm-hmm. Whereas being a codependent, I am 100% in agreement with you, because what lengths would you go to or not go to help your loved one? Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that you're dropping your entire life and you're focusing on this one person. It's, I love this person. I see what's happening. I want to help. There are some people who may get lost in it. And True. Then sure, we can label them that way, the traditional label. But I believe, like you're saying, majority of the people, that's not what it is. I'm doing what I can because I love the person. I want to help because I'm the last line of defense, so to speak.
Yeah. I think most of these things, we're on a continuum, a spectrum of behavior, and it starts in one place. It can go to the extreme. And that's our job along the way. Unfortunately, when we are in the middle of these addictive, traumatic situations, we often can't see ourselves. The pain is there. We are so focused on the addict and our family. You know, we've got children to protect often. Mm-hmm. There's worry about our financial situation. What happens if he crashes the car and kills someone? I'm the one that has to clean up the pieces. This is the reality. And your life just slowly is taken over by addiction. And those of us that are on the sidelines, we are often not aware of how deep we've gone into this. We're often not aware of how much of ourself we are losing in the process. Mm-hmm. And I have spoken to so many people post-relationship who say the same thing, which is, why did I do it for so long? Because we are in this process where our own mental health is suffering. We're so busy keeping everybody else together, we can't see what's happening to us until we step away and there is some opportunity for clarity. Only then can we see how bad things really were for us, how empty, how confused, how much pain. But we think of it in the moment as, I got to keep this guy alive. I have to keep my family intact. I have to protect everybody. That's the reality of how sucked in, I guess, we get to the relationship. And it is just not easy to say, okay, you're on your own. Adios.
Right, because I think that for the folks who are on the sideline of this, you can, at some point in time, you can envision what are the possibilities that will happen to your loved one, the addict, to, if you have a family, to the kids. And like I said, God forbid they get in an accident, they kill someone else, then your financial, you, the sideline, is left to pick up all the pieces. But how is it that you either drew that line in the sand or in your mind and said, I cannot go beyond this point? How is it that people can identify with that and do that?
Mm-hmm. Addiction is not linear. There are mm-hmm. so many ups and downs in this process. And that's part of why it takes so long. And that's part of why we stay in these relationships for so long. Because every moment of, yes, I'm going to go to a meeting. Yes, I will stop drinking for 2 months. Whatever it is, that's our hope. We're keeping that hope alive. It's really only when we lose hope that we can really start separating ourselves from the addict and the situation. And that's a hard thing. When do you stop? When does hope die? But unfortunately, one way or the other, these things are going to play out in very limited ways. Your addict is going to get sober. Your addict is going to die. Or the two of you just stay in this drunken relationship forever and you're both miserable. There's nothing in between. There just isn't.
Yeah.
And that's the choice that eventually we have to make. So for us, there were multiple, again, this went on for decades. So we had many, many moments of what felt like hope. And that was part of, I guess, my thought process as I went through the, do I stay, do I go? It's too good to leave and too bad to stay. That's the dilemma. As long as he was trying, I was there. If he had not been trying, that would have been an easier marker for me. And for anybody who is in this position, I would think about that question first. I mean, really think about that. Are you hearing dismissive, angry, blaming statements every time the subject of alcohol comes up? This is not a person who wants to get better right now. They're not able. So you're going to have to make some tough decisions. If the addict is working on it, that's a whole other story, and you've got other issues to that you can kind of throw more tools at them. Ultimately, it is the addict's choice. There is nothing that we as individuals, we as loved ones can do beyond holding the mirror up to the addict to say, okay, you have a choice to make. And that was eventually the choice that I put to my former husband. You can have me or you can have vodka. And sometimes that reality works and sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it's, you know, rehab number five. This is just how the process works. It is not linear and it is so dependent on the readiness of the addict to face reality. In our situation, my former husband eventually went to rehab, but he went kicking and screaming. He didn't fully believe he was an addict until he got into rehab, and he could see men, career men, successful men like he was, suffering of the same problem. They were further down the path. They were yellow with jaundice as their livers were failing. They were in wheelchairs because they could no longer walk. Their health was so bad. And that actually was a really big wake-up call for him to say, this is my future. So there are moments along the way that we can put the addict in front of that mirror. But like that horse to water analogy, you know, or saying, we can't make them drink. And many, many, many people, if not all, go through some process of convincing themselves that they are going to get sober, they're firmly going to do it, they're committed, and relapse occurs. That is part of the process. We have to face that. We have to accept that. And also, as loved ones, we have to understand that the confusion that we feel is because we see this all as this logical process, but the addict doesn't view any of this logically. They aren't putting, what are you doing to your family first, top of mind? What are you doing to your body, top of mind? The substance has rewired their brains. They can only focus on whatever emotional need, what emotional hole the substance fills for them. So logic gets shoved way down into the background. We, on the other hand, we've got logic. And, you know, the occasional emotion of when we're angry and confused. But it's that battle between us that is really, really complicated. And for anybody that has been in or is in the position that I was in, you will help yourself out a great deal by understanding to set aside these moments of logic, the frustration over why can't he see what he's doing to me, to himself, to his family. He can't. The logic just is not top of mind. Yeah. Certainly not while alcohol is in the body or substance. It takes a couple years without substance for that brain to get back to a non-addictive state.
I want to add too, but none of this is a guarantee that the addict is going to get better. And as you said, it's no matter how much help they get, no matter how much help we give, if they don't want it, even if they say they want it, they may not really either know how, or they really don't want to, because there's always going to be a reason to have a drink. Well, let me just have one. I'm not going to get drunk. Well, it's not about getting drunk. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I just, the reason I said that is I don't want people to think, oh, this is a guy that's going to tell me how to fix my husband or my wife or the alcoholic I'm around. No, it is a guide. It is to let the survivor, the sideline person, understand. I'm thinking it's not our fault.
Correct.
It's not our fault if we can't fix, because it's not our decision. Yeah. All we can do is be there to help, but we need to know when we have to walk away so it doesn't harm us or harm our children, the family. So
it's a really complex situation for the loved one around guilt. Mm-hmm. Because if the person you love is not hearing your message, we take that personally. Obviously, he just doesn't love me enough to get sober. This is a very common reaction for those of us on the sidelines, that we are not getting through to the person that is most important to us in life. And we believe we are the person most important to them. And this guilt that we can't get through is something that we carry with us for a very long time. And it is important that for our own healing, that we try to separate the logic of this out and think about, what is it that I have not done? Okay, then do that. But getting to the place where you have done everything in your power, and you have to find a way to set aside the guilt if it doesn't proceed the way you want to. Because the addict, you've given everything you can, every tool available, every conversation, every option, every rehab, every tear, whatever it is, every fight you have. The addict has to be ready to take charge of their life. Yeah. And in their sober moments, yes, of course they say they want to. But the cycle of their guilt and their shame around the need is always present, and that's what brings them back. Their brains are not yet, like I said, the brains have been rewired, and there is some emotional void underneath the substance that has not been dealt with. So what? But it also can't be dealt with until the substance is out of the person's system. It's really hard to process both of those things at once. You can know it exists, but you can't heal yourself from whatever that deep emotional wound is and get sober at the same time. It is a layered approach. You've got to be moving towards both goals, but you're going to get the substance out first before you're going to heal the emotional void inside the individual. And we can't do that for them. We can only offer up our love, our support, and our solutions. And sometimes the bravest thing that we can do for them and for ourselves is to say, I love you. I've done everything I can for you, but I have to walk away. Talk to me again if you ever get this, you get this resolved. If you can work through this, I'm still here, but I can't have you in my life right now, because one of you is going to go down. And are you willing to go down with the ship? It's kind of a very harsh way to put it. But that is a reality, because the longer you are in this addictive relationship that is not changing, that is not progressing, the more you are damaged emotionally. And then you too have this emotional hole inside you that will perpetuate with or without that addict in your life.
Yeah, if I can liken it to a race, it's a race that you will never win, because they will never let you. The addict will never let you win. And that's not by, it's by their choice, but it's not them saying, well, I'm not going to let them do this. No. It's like I said, the brain has been rewired. Mm-hmm. It's almost like they just don't know better.
Correct. That's an excellent way to think about it. And it's important that we as loved ones understand that, because we get so frustrated with the, why don't you see this? Why can't you fix this? And it does help emotionally if we can, I guess, find some more clinical language as we think about what they are capable of while they're still using whatever it is they're using. Mm-hmm. There is simply a limit on what they can do. And we will be at a better place to try to have a little emotional distance, a little clinical understanding of that as we process whatever decisions we need to make, whether the addict is trying to heal or not trying to heal, whether we stay in the relationship or whether we have to leave the relationship. That's just part of the process, and it's important. It's a really important thing, because I view trauma as contagious. You know, mm-hmm. If that addict has an emotional void somewhere caused by something in their past, often a childhood thing, if we don't hold on to our own mental health, we then have created another, their problem, their emotional void has rubbed off on us in a different way. It's become our emotional void. And we then spread that to our children and our loved ones, and it goes on and on. So it's really important, regardless of what we do about the relationship, to be focused on, as much as we can, our own mental health, our own healing, so that we are not staying damaged. I think anybody mm-hmm. in an addictive relationship has emotional voids. There's damage, emotional damage occurring. But you have the choice on whether you fix that or not, whether you stay broken.
I yes, absolutely right about that. And I think the person who is involved with the addict, alcoholic, oftentimes, I'll say from the man being the alcoholic and the woman being the sideliner, you know, it can boil down to fear of being alone or not having someone with you. Don't be afraid of that. It's okay. You are never alone. It's just really in your mind as that sideline person that you're alone. But you're not, because you have other family members, you have friends, you have resources, although they may be a little bit more limited or difficult to find if you're the sideline person, but that is out there. So don't be afraid to do what you have to do. Like I said, in order to really comes down to saving yourself now. Find that line and say no more.
It's a common challenge for anybody who is in a relationship that is struggling. There's a fear. I know this. I don't know what might be coming outside of this relationship. So yes, fear of being alone is part of it. For in certain relationships, the fear of the financial, it is a huge issue. How do I support myself? How do I support my children if I leave him? Often, this wasn't something that occurred in my situation, but often surrounding family members can be particularly harsh to the sober spouse. You can't leave him. What's going to happen to him? And so there's additional pressure there. But if we are in the place where we think we are staying together, we're staying in this relationship to protect our children, thinking it's a better intact, think about what you're teaching your children. You're teaching your child to be silent. You're teaching your child that it's okay to be treated badly. Those aren't good things. You're teaching a child what an addictive, that, you know, addictive relationships are what normal, healthy relationships are supposed to look like. And that is not. So it is not an easy decision under any circumstance to end a long-term relationship.
Yeah.
But we overcomplicate it with our fears. We overcomplicate it thinking we are protecting others by staying together. When in some situations, the leaving can show your partner, your children, your family members that it's a stronger, healthier place to be and that you have done something important by managing. I've learned something here, but I need to protect myself. Because you can't be a good parent. You can't be a good partner if you are broken.
Yeah.
We have to maintain our mental health in order to be good at any of those things, whether it's an addictive relationship or anything, any other kind of relationship. If we are not happy and healthy, we can't be a happy, healthy partner. It's important to not diminish the power of our own mental health inside relationship, relationship with the world, and not just romantic relationships.
Well, what you're just now saying, or at least struck a chord where I'm thinking about it as with your family. I don't have a family, but if you stay in that addictive relationship and your children are viewing this, you're perpetuating, and it gives them permission if they are in a relationship like that when they become adults. Like you said, oh, this is normal behavior. Well, we know that it's not normal, but this is what they saw and this is what they're used to. And they end up doing what mom or dad or whoever was their peer. And it's just a behavior that they've become accustomed to. So yes, in order for you to stop that, you have to stop yourself right now and protect the future. You know, if it's a family, if it's kids, protect the future.
And sometimes these things are not forever. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we can step away from a relationship for a period of time, and that's the mirror moment that the alcoholic needs to get their life together. Sometimes that's what it takes, and you get together later. Don't think every decision you make has to be a permanent forever decision. Permanent and forever is death.
Yeah.
Emotional death included.
Very well said, because you're right. Just because you decide I'm stepping away does not mean that the person gets better and says, you know what, I've changed. And you say, you have. You're different. Let's see how we work together. Mm-hmm. And if it works, it works. But, you know, I guess what I'm thinking of is don't hold yourself to that. This is it. Because there's always a possibility of something. So, and the only true end is death. Yeah. But you've really explained a lot about how you feel about codependency and enabling. And I think a lot of people are going to be able to identify with that and say, you know what? I did not believe that I was that way in specific medical type terms, psychological terms, psychiatric terms, as a codependent or an enabler. And the way you explained it and said it is exactly, I think, how I would feel and many people. It's almost like, well, don't tell me that I'm doing that, or don't tell me I'm like that. We become defensive. Mm-hmm.
As I had to think about this concept of enabling, and it comes up a lot in therapy and in rehab centers, and you are forced to deal with it. I mean, we can be dismissive and say, no, I don't do that. I took some time with that. But the one thing that I could say that I did that was enabling is I stayed with him. Mm-hmm. That in itself can be an enabling behavior, even though we don't think about it that way. But it is an enabling behavior at some point.
Sure. You're protecting them from harm, so you're enabling. They're like, you know what? I could go do this stuff, and everything's going to be fixed for me. You don't mean for it to be that way. They don't mean for it to be that way. It just happens to be that way.
Yeah. And even if you're not fixing or not interfering in consequences, you as the partner, there's a consequence. Me leaving is a consequence. It's like the most extreme consequence in relationship. And that eventually that was the card I had to pull. But along the way, when you're having these conversations and these moments of, I think he's getting it, no, he's not, and you're threatening, or you're leaving for a few days and you're coming back, and we all do that, they assume that you always will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This, again, I just want people to know where they can reach out to find information about you and your book. And is it pronounced your last name, Killian?
Correct. So I have a website, danakillian.com. Mm-hmm. The book is available there. It's available any place that you like to buy your books. But I do have links on my website. I have a link to the media. I have links to a little journal blog, if you will, that I do. Social media. I'm on Instagram, Dana Killian Author. Facebook, the same. And basically any place you like to buy your books, the book is available. It's available in print. It is available as an ebook and also as audio.
And I'll add, while you're there looking and purchasing her memoir, take a look at some of the mystery books too. Dana, this has been really wonderful. I think it's going to help a lot of people. I honestly do. So I just want to say thank you very much for your time today and to have, you know, this conversation about you, what you went through, and your memoir. So thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. It's an important subject for so many.
You're welcome.